Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in McLean against Huddleston and the consolidated case. Truett, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, there are two issues presented in this appeal. The first issue is whether or not purchasers of registered securities who may sue under Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933 may also have recourse to the implied remedies permitted under Section 17A of the Securities Act of 1933 and under Rule 10b-5 of the Securities Act of 1934. The second issue is whether in such implied remedies cases the standard of evidence is the clear and convincing standard or is a preponderance of the evidence standard. Herman and McLean is my client. It is a firm of certified public accountants with offices in Detroit, Michigan. Herman and McLean were the auditors for Texas International Speedway in connection with a public offering of securities which occurred in November of 1969, in the heyday of the go-go period. That offering of securities was underwritten on a firm commitment basis by a group of underwriters headed by Ladenburg Thalmann and Company. The offering of securities was successful.
Is that some term of art, go-go period?
I think it's gotten to be, Your Honor. It's a term which has been applied frequently. I think there's a book called The Go-Go Years,
really?
Which describes the period of the late 60s and early 70s, in which it seemed that purchasers of investors...
Did we find it in Westlaw or someplace like that?
You may, Your Honor. I'm not sure. I haven't looked at that. But I think it's a term that has a commonly understood significance in the securities industry, if not in the legal profession.
You haven't told me what it is yet.
I beg your pardon?
You haven't told me what it is yet. I'd like to know if you're going to...
The go-go period I would define as the period of the late 60s and early 70s during which the appetite for speculative security seemed to be very high. We've not had, except sporadically, a recurrence of that sort of appetite for speculative securities.
All right. Now I know.
The operations of Texas International Speedway were not successful. On November 30, 1970, which was some 13 months after the offering, Texas International Speedway filed a petition for bankruptcy under Chapter 10 of the federal bankruptcy laws. On August 25, 1972, which was approximately 21 months after the filing of bankruptcy proceedings and just short of 3 years after the effective date of the public offering, the plaintiffs in this lawsuit filed their action in the federal district court. Section 11 of the Securities Act of 1933 is a piece of legislation directed specifically at public offerings of securities. It is a statute which was designed specifically for the plaintiffs in this case. Section 11 was intended by Congress to accomplish certain things. It was intended to, as this Court has observed in Hockfelder, to make certain that all material information necessary to permit an investor to make an informed judgment would be available for that investor. It was also intended to enhance standards of integrity and fair dealing through the imposition of specified civil liabilities. And I think the operative word for my purposes in that paraphrase of Hockfelder is the term specified. In order to protect the capital formation process, Congress deemed it necessary to advise those persons participating in public offerings as to what the scope of their liabilities would be. Congress did that very specifically in Section 11. Every participant in a section or in a registration statement can read Section 11 and tell precisely what the scope of his liability is, whether he is the issuer, a director, an officer of the company, an underwriter, or an accountant. He can tell what his liabilities are. Notwithstanding the availability of Section 11, the plaintiffs, as I have said, chose to sue under 10b-5 and 17a. By doing so, they accomplished three objectives. They avoided limitations claims, which would have been particularly difficult under the facts of this case. They broadened the basis for liability of those persons who they named as defendants. In particular reference to my client, a public accounting firm, by suing under 10b-5 rather than Section 11, the plaintiffs were permitted to allege that accountants are responsible for non-accounting materials, for materials that appeared in the prospectus, in the use of proceeds table, and elsewhere, despite the fact that those materials not only were not expertized by my client, by the accounting firm, but were in fact expertized by other experts. Probably the clearest example that you can find in Section 11 of the type of representation for which one expert is not liable, that is, something expertized by another expert.
What does expertized, we're getting an education, what does expertized mean, Mr. Chip?
Expertized, a piece of expertized material is material which is included in a registration statement on the basis of the authority of an expert. A prospectus, and the prospectus in this case, has a section entitled Experts, and it says, it identifies that portion of the prospectus that is included therein on the basis of the authority of an expert, and it identifies which expert it is and what the materials are. For example, in this case, the expert section stated that the estimated cost of building the speedway was expertized by a firm of engineers. And yet, notwithstanding the fact that it was expertized by engineers and not by accountants, the plaintiffs, by suing under 10b-5, were permitted to allege that the accountants were responsible as a result of the fact that those estimates were incorrect.
What is the theory on which they do that, on which the plaintiffs seek to assess liability against the accountants for something like that was done?
Well, the plaintiffs allege both that the accountants were acting as principal and that they were acting as aiders and abettors. That is to say that even though they were not responsible for those estimates, they are charged with knowledge of the incorrectness of those estimates, and that knowledge serves to satisfy the scienter requirement of 10b-5 and Section 17.
Where does the concept of aiders and abettors in civil litigation come from?
It seems to me that it has been borrowed from the criminal law without a great deal of analysis. It has been taken in whole from the criminal law, and the courts have applied it, holding that the elements are an awareness, a generalized awareness that there is some illegal activity going on, and the performance of some conduct which materially contributes to the accomplishment of the illegal purpose.
Do any of the relevant securities acts passed by Congress use the term aiders and abettors?
No, Your Honor, they do not.
How about committee reports?
They're not in connection with the 33 or 34 acts. There was a committee report. There was a proposal, as I recall, in 1959 or 1960 to use the term aider and abettor in application to certain administrative processes. But the Commission advised the Congress at that time that the aider and abettor analysis would apply only as regards administrative processes, SEC regulation, and that it did not at that time regard the aider and abettor concept as applicable for civil purposes. In any event, that legislation in which that proposal was made did not come to fruition. The other major accomplishment of suing under 17A and 10B5 rather than Section 11 has to do with the issue of damages. The damages provisions of Section 11 are well-defined and fairly restrictive. The principal restriction, which is operative generally, is that a participant in the registration process is liable only for an amount equal to the price at which the securities were offered to the public. Therefore, if you have a situation in which securities are offered to the public at $5 a share and trade thereafter at $10 or $15 a share, notwithstanding that increase in price, the participants in the registration process under Section 11 are liable only for $5 per share. Another very important distinction in the area of damages has to do with underwriters. An underwriter is generally liable only for that portion of the securities underwritten by him. There is an exception where an underwriter receives compensation, which is not shared pro rata with all other underwriters. But aside from that exception, an underwriter may be responsible only for that portion of the securities which he underwrites. In the facts of the present case, that's fairly graphically demonstrated by Russ and Company, which I've chosen just because they're one of the smaller underwriters. They underwrote 30 units out of the 3,300 units which were sold in this offering. Under Section 11, the aggregate liability of Russ and Company would have been $44,000. Under 10b-5 or under 17a, if those statutes provide implied remedies, the liability of Russ and Company would be $4,400,000 plus any additional premium over and above that, which might arise as a result of the fact that those securities trade at a premium. So the effect of permitting plaintiffs recourse to 10b-5 and 17a is to dramatically increase the exposure of certain defendants. One other significant effect is that Section 11 only imposes liability on certain persons. Not every participant in the process of preparing a registration statement or bringing an offering to market is even potentially liable. For example, attorneys for underwriters are not liable under Section 11. To use the facts of our case, the general contractor who was going to build a speedway, which would have been paid for out of the funds of this offering, was not liable under Section 11. In this case, however, the plaintiffs were permitted to sue under 10b-5 and 17a, and they were permitted to sue the attorneys for the underwriters and the general contractor. Now, this Court has previously remarked on the interim effects of 10b-5 litigation. It is a terrifying prospect because of the large amounts which may be involved, because of the large expenses which are incurred in defending oneself. The fact of the matter is that 10b-5 lawsuits are frequently, if not generally, brought for their settlement value because of the fact that the risks of trial can be enormous. The trial of a 10b-5 lawsuit is a difficult and tedious proposition for the attorneys and for the judge. As a result of that, federal judges frequently encourage, even demand, that the suit be settled before trial. And a defendant resists this demand at his grave peril.
How can a federal judge demand that a suit be settled before a trial?
By calling counsel into his chambers and saying, gentlemen, this is a lawsuit which I think should be settled. I believe very strongly it should be settled. Now, those demands will not always be heeded, but they may be made. And they were made in this case.
Well, what is the implied sanction which the judge has to back up what you describe as a demand?
Well, in this case, Your Honor, Herman and McLean refused to settle. And it suffered five consequences of refusing to settle. First off, it lost virtually every evidentiary ruling which was made.
Well, it might have anyway.
It might have anyway, Your Honor. However,
very likely would.
It might have, Your Honor, but if you let me go on through the other list of things that happened, I think there is a pattern.
Before you leave that, isn't one partial response to that question that some district judges will drop a hint here and there as to what they might do if a party doesn't show some activity toward settlement?
Yes, Your Honor, that can be done, and I'm sure it has been done. But I think the facts of this case are more graphic than one would normally find. Getting back to the evidentiary rulings, which might or might not be correct, and which we might or might not have lost. Secondly, the jury charge. The jury charge was given in virtually the same language submitted by the plaintiffs. The jury charge was obviously and flagrantly defective. There was no charge given as to reliance. There was no charge given as to causation. The failure to give those charges, despite the insistence of the defendants that they be given, required the Court of Appeals to reverse this case and remand it. Thirdly, the district court bifurcated this proceeding for two trials, a trial on liability and then a trial on damages. After the trial on liability and without any evidence being submitted on the issue of damages, a final judgment covering both liability and damages was entered. Fourthly, attorney's fees in the amount of $1 million were awarded in this case. $500,000 to come from the amount recovered on behalf of the class, $500,000 assessed as additional damages. In complete disregard of the holdings of this court, which do not permit under the American rule the assessment of attorney's fees as additional damages without some finding of wrongdoing over and above the establishment of the elements of the cause of action in the case. The district judge did not specify what it was that justified the assessment of these damages, these attorney's fees as damages, but that nevertheless occurred. Finally, after a judgment was entered, the defendants filed a motion for stay based upon a supersedious bond, which was less than the supersedious bond called for by the local rule. A hearing was had on that motion, and at that hearing, the district judge gave, on the record, as his only basis for refusing to grant that motion, the fact that the defendants had refused to heed his demand that the lawsuit be settled. Normally, the causal relationship between a refusal to heed a settlement demand and the animus of a district court is a matter of greater speculation than it is in this case. But I submit that it is on the record in this case. The significance of this course of events in this appeal, and the point that I'm trying to make, is that Section 11, because of its much greater precision, does not lend itself to these kinds of interorum tactics, as does 10b-5. And therefore, the integrity of Section 11, I submit, should be preserved. Getting over for a moment to the standard of evidence issue as it relates to the resolution of the overlapping remedies issue. The difficulty in briefing and deciding the standard of evidence applicable in an implied remedies case is the absence of any rule of decision to point to determine which standard should apply. After preparing our brief and reading the other briefs, it seems to me that what it comes down to is a subjective determination of the degree of protection which the court should extend to persons accused of civil fraud, taking into account the special damages to reputations which can follow from a fraud judgment. Now, I would point out that this problem is not a problem in Section 11 cases. There's no need to attempt to determine which standard of evidence applies, because in a Section 11 case, the burden is on the plaintiffs to go forward and show that a registration statement is false and misleading. But once that burden is satisfied, then the burden is on the defendant to establish defenses related to lack of culpability, which every defendant other than the issuer has. This is an example, it seems to me, of the superiority of the Section 11 cause of action. We don't find ourselves in this never-never world of trying to determine by access to federal common law or by, as is the case with respect to the statute of limitations, by reference to what is deemed to be the most comparable state statute of limitations period, the rule applicable to the proceeding. Now, the question presented in this appeal seems to me to be a very straightforward one, and that is whether the federal courts are obligated to respect the express statutory remedy for registered offerings provided by Congress. If the courts are obligated to respect that statutory scheme, then the various elements of that scheme must be respected. The statute of limitations period must be respected. The other attributes of the express remedy must be respected. When that occurs, it seems to me there's no room left for the existence of implied remedies. Now, the problem of analysis here seems to me to be, to some degree, a semantic problem. The plaintiffs and the commission speak in terms of cumulative or supplemental remedies. Now, those terms sound innocuous enough, but the fact is that one cannot permit a cumulative or supplemental remedy to stand alongside an express remedy in those circumstances where the cumulative remedy provides a result which is proscribed by the express remedy. And a good example is the limitations period. A plaintiff cannot both sue under Section 11 and be forced to comply with the limitations period provided by Section 13 of the 1933 Act, and also sue under 10b-5 and have recourse to the longer limitations period provided by that kind of action. The court must select one or the other. And it seems to me that in a situation such as this, where Congress has spoken, the court is obligated to respect what Congress has said. Now, the commission and the plaintiffs point out the fact that there are preservations of remedies clauses in the 1933 and 1934 Acts, and indeed there are. Those provisions, however, do not imply the existence of an implied federal remedy. Section 16 of the 1933 Act was enacted at a time when there was no doctrine of implied federal securities laws remedies. It was enacted before the Securities Act of 1934 was enacted. Therefore, it could not have been enacted in contemplation of a 10b-5 cause of action. That provision seems to me clearly to contemplate the survival of state common law remedies, and I think that that fact is borne out by the existence of Section 22 of the 1933 Act. Section 22 provides that actions may be brought either in the state court or in the federal court, and further provides that if brought in the state court, such actions may not be removed to the federal court. The 34 Act, Section 27 of the 34 Act, provides exactly the opposite. It provides that actions brought under the 1934 Act may be brought only in the federal courts. The federal courts have exclusive jurisdiction over such actions.
Mr. Truitt, may I ask, under your view, what remedy you think a defrauded purchaser of registered securities would have? Does that person have a 10b-5 implied action, do you think, or only if he doesn't have a Section 11 remedy, or what?
A purchaser who alleges to have been defrauded in connection with the purchase of registered securities may sue under Section 11. Now, Section 11 is a fraud statute. Under some circumstances, a defendant can avoid liability by showing that he did not act negligently. But the plaintiff must first show fraud, at least to the degree that fraud is defined as there being something false or misleading about the registration statement. Now, as to certain people, negligence is not the standard. For example, as to a director who is trying to avoid, or an underwriter who is trying to avoid liability with respect to something appearing in the financial statements, he is not required to show negligence, or he's not required to disprove negligence. He is required only to disprove that he did not act either recklessly or intentionally. So the notion that Section 13 is a negligence statute and therefore constitutes a different sort of animal from 10b-5 is, I think, an erroneous notion. They are both fraud statutes. They contemplate different schemes, and under some circumstances, a proof that a person has not been either negligent nor behaved intentionally will provide a defense. But it's nevertheless a fraud statute. Now, if a person finds himself outside the scope of that statute because the limitations period is run or because he wants to sue the attorney for the underwriters or for any of a number of other reasons, such a person may still sue in state courts. And that is why the preservation of remedies language is there. And that is why the 33 Act provides that actions alleging liability under Section 11 may be brought in the state courts, and if brought in the state courts, must be maintained in the state courts. The argument has been made that it would be wrong not to permit recovery under Section 10b because of the fact that the Congress intended the securities laws, and particularly the 34 Act, to be complete and effective. The Commission has cited in support of that proposition Section 2 of the 1934 Act. If it please the Court, I will reserve the remainder of my time unless there are questions for rebuttal.
Very well. Mr. Jaffe.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the Court. First issue before the Court today is framed by cross-petitioner Herman McLean, who suggested in footnote 15 this Court's decision in blue chip stamps be manor drug stores, whether implied action under Section 10b of the 1934 Act and Rule 10b-5 will lie for actions made a violation of the 1933 Act and the subject of express civil remedies under the 1933 Act, the civil remedy provisions being Section 11 and Section 12.2, Section 12.1 for unregistered securities, not involved here. Important fact here, and certainly it becomes more important fact in view of some of the comments made by counsel, is that the fraud committed by Herman and McLean was for actions that, for the most part, are not covered by the express provisions of Section 11 of the 1933 Act, as they pertain to an expert accountant such as Herman McLean, named as an expert in a prospectus, but named in a limited way, only consented to a certain portion of the prospectus or registration statement as being expertized. This distinction is highlighted by the unique circumstance of this case. Unlike most other cases recently decided by this Court, dealing with the scope of Section 10b and Rule 10b-5, cases such as Hockfelter, Blue Chip Stamps, and Santa Fe Industries, where the factual allegations of fraud were based on pleadings made in a complaint This case becomes before you after a jury, a trial judge, somewhat inclined trial judge here, and the Fifth Circuit had determined Herman McLean had violated Rule 10b-5 and that the trial record justified a finding scienter for a course of conduct intended to deceive purchases of securities which would meet a clear and convincing standard of proof. I call attention to the court of footnote 13 to the decision. Judge Rubin below, I don't have to read it precisely. It is the smoking gun letter, which is found in the appendix at 257A, the letter dated May 20, 1969, in which Herman McLean states, "We have calculated the expenses from the figures given to us, from the contracts, and the other information obtained, and it would appear that the total cost of building the speedway and for the initial cost to bring it into operation would be $488,000 above that which would be available from the sale of the issue and part from mortgage financing." Then there's a meeting at Larry's house, Larry Little Payton, the president of TIS, where after that meeting, there's another letter that comes out. The letter is also found in the appendix at 267A, June 9, 1969, where Herman McLean indicates that it reduced cost as a consequence of that meeting. Again, as found by the court below, found by the Judge Rubin after reviewing the whole trial record, the costs that were pawed from the preparer of the use of proceeds section, Herman McLean, were costs which in fact had been contracted for prior to the date of his letter, June 9, 1969. So we have here is clear evidence according to the jury, according to the trial judge, and according to the Fifth Circuit who reviewed the whole record, that the evidence against Herman McLean was not just possible of gross negligence, but of the type of evidence that would meet a clear and convincing standard of fraud.
Counsel, do you think the Court of Appeals held that the clear and convincing standard applied to proof of knowledge or scienter only, or to proof of all the elements of the 10B?
Justice Connor, that's a good question because I don't know the answer. This was a sua sponte decision by the Fifth Circuit. It was never raised by any party. I, in reading the decision, cannot answer that question. I don't know what's going to happen if we get down to if the clear and convincing standard is upheld by this court as being the standard in a civil fraud action, as to whether that's going to apply to the element of materiality, whether it's going to apply to the element of reliance, whether it's going to apply to the element of causation, how are they going to break that down? It would seem to me that it seems to apply across the board as to each particular element, as it's phrased in the Fifth Circuit's decision. But I really don't know what the answer would be, and I imagine if this Court upheld that standard, it's going to have to be explored on a case-by-case basis.
Well, isn't the common law standard of clear and convincing evidence in an action for civil fraud across the board as to all the elements with respect to which the plaintiff bears the burden of proof?
Well, Your Honor, it differs from state to state. I know my state, I come really from New Jersey, not Texas. It's a preponderance standard, for sure.
But in those states where there is a clear and convincing standard, isn't it all elements, just as I presume in New Jersey, it's all elements?
I think it would be all elements, Your Honor. And to deal with that very quickly, we have, and I don't want to deal with it quickly because it's very important, we might have met it in this case according to the Fifth Circuit, but it's going to put a very big burden under the securities laws if that's applied to all 10b-5 cases. What is at risk here is money damages. That was what was at risk here, and we've talked about it being a lot of money damages, but the fact remains it's still money damages. Herman McLean was never required to not practice in front of the SEC, not required to limit their activities, were not enjoined in any way, and I don't the opprobrium which they attached to this decision that needing a clear and convincing standard does not seem to comport with the other decisions of this court which would find only in special circumstances, deportation hearings, confinement to a mental institution. I don't think it comes to that.
Well, Mr. Jaffe, this is a question that might just as well be put to your opponent as to you, and perhaps is not proper in the light of some of our court's decision. But how many juries do you think would reach a different result if they're charged that they have, you have to find by clear and convincing evidence as opposed to a preponderance?
Well, I think they would. I think juries pay attention to the charges of the court. One of the things in every trial is the judge makes quite clear, even when they pick out the jurors, are you going to are you going to follow the directions of this court? I remember in this case, there was one juror that says, any director that's involved in fraud, I would find liable. And then the judge said, well, it may be a difference of culpability under the controlling person standard. And he dismissed that person from the jury. I think the jury has to follow the law. The jury has explained properly the differences between clear and convincing and preponderance of the evidence. They're going to follow it. This jury, I felt, was a very good jury, a discerning jury, made decisions between culpability as to the various defendants here.
Your feeling is certainly understandable in view of their verdict.
Some of them, Your Honor, they found were not culpable under the Sienta standard, although we had an action, we don't have it anymore, under the Texas Securities Act, which is follows Section 11 as a negligent standard. We chose to go for the Sienta standard as to both, on the basis that if there was such a finding, we would then get damages for attorney's fees, which we felt would come under the Texas Securities Act. So I do think there's a big difference. The findings of fraud with Sienta, with which Herman McLean admits, indeed advocates in its reply brief, are not covered by the express liability provisions of Section 11 of the 1933 Act. Conscious of these findings made by the lower courts as the Sienta, Herman McLean has resorted to the defense of no writ, no right. There was one part of the reply brief in which Herman McLean mentioned, I'll find the reply brief, that no purchase, this is found at page 7 of the reply brief, no purchaser of the securities, certainly Mr. Huddleston, Mr. Bradley, had any basis from a reading of the prospectus for relying upon Herman and McLean for the accuracy of estimated cost of construction. I agree that when you look at the prospectus, you would not know as a purchaser that it was Herman and McLean, as we proved during trial, who was the party essentially responsible for the use of proceeds section for putting together the construction figures. Because as part of the fraud, an essential part of the fraud found by the jury in the answers to special interrogatories to be an essence of the fraud, was that they got the engineers to give a comfort letter, which everybody connected with the prospectus knew was untrue, that they had calculated the estimated costs remaining and had found it to be accurate. They never did, and they knew this to be fact. And this is, again, what was picked up by Judge Rubin. They refused to give comfort concerning the construction costs, Herman McLean, in its comfort letter, October 30, 1969, because they knew. This is one of the reasons why the court below found clear and convincing evidence of their participation in the fraud. And also, may I say, it is Herman McLean. There is an administrative process. Herman McLean is the one that responds to the letters of comment which the Securities Exchange Commission send in respect to these registration statements. And that would be found, for example, there was a letter of the Securities Exchange Commission found at 284 of the appendix asking for updated financial statements. The person that responds to this information is Herman McLean, and they certainly did not put the information requested by the Securities Commission, because if they had done so, the fraud would have been revealed, the material adverse financial information regarding the construction of the Speedway would have been revealed. It would have been disclosed. So Herman McLean was definitely a direct participant, as found by the jury, as found by the trial court, and yet these are areas outside of Section 11. because the use of proceeds section does not come under the liability area of the Section 11. I know that I hope that a chart was handed up to the court as to the differences between the two causes of action. And regarding persons subject to liability under Section 11, it's a narrow class of persons of a direct role in the registered offering, including experts only, we use that word, expertise, portion of registration statement. To that portion of the registration statement to which they gave their consent to affix the name. In this case, it was the certified statement for the year ending May 30, 1969. They did not give their consent, they claim, during trial. Indeed, I had an expert accountant testify, would not ordinarily review the case, to the pro forma balance sheet, which purported to show the effect of the issue, purported to show when the issue was sold and the monies collected, there would be $93,000 of working capital, and there would also be $278,000 of monies reserved, cash reserved, to meet the expenses to the opening day. In fact, there was $500,000 deficit in the working capital position of the TIS the day they received the proceeds of the issue.
Well, is the question with respect to those defendants who are subject to liability under Section 11, is the question whether Congress intended their liability under that section to be exclusive? Is that the question?
Yeah, I think that's the question which is being put by plaintiffs, saying since Congress did not provide that this class of person would be liable for fraud, of the fraud type of fraud found by the jury here, he's exempt. He can get away with it. He can commit fraud with impunity.
You're saying that's just a reason for saying Congress didn't intend their liability to be exclusive under that section.
Yes, Your Honor. I don't think they intended the liability exclusive under that section. I think Congress intended that when the commission was appointed.
Well, why provide for it at all?
What's that, Your Honor?
Why have Section 11 at all?
Because it's a very strict liability section for negligence. Mm-hmm. Now, where a person states in the prospectus, you can rely upon me as an expert, and he makes a gross mistake without intent, mm-hmm. and that's the whole point.
He's stuck. Not so under another section.
No, Your Honor, there's no other section providing for a negligent standard. No. Certainly 10b-5 is not a negligent standard. Before you can catch in that catch-all section of the 1934
Act. You've got to be more than negligent.
A lot more than negligence, Your Honor. It has to be, I think, a proof that can meet Rule 9b first in the pleading. Before you even get near a trial, the courts are now uniformly looking at Rule 9b to plead fraud with particularity, particularly in securities case, as the key way to knock out these strike and nuisance suits. And I think that is the kind of procedural limitation which you're not going to have in a Section 11. Section 11, you say, look, there was a mistake, gross mistake, it's material, and now they have to come in and defend, Justice White. They have to come in and prove their due diligence, show the chart that they followed through, making sure they did everything. It's not so in a 10b-5 action. 10b-5 action, you allege fraud, that court's going to say particularity. In fact, there's a second part of that 10b which says you can veer malice or intent with generality, but the courts, I think, are looking at the particularization of fraud to even include the intent portions. The second line of defense, Herman McLean argues that if this court allows a private right of action under Rule 10b-5 with respect to a fraud involving preparation and delivery of false misleading prospectus, it would nullify the procedural restrictions, i.e., bring in those procedural restrictions then on 10b-5. Well, it's forgotten one of the procedural restrictions is the posting of a bond, but that bond was posted for two purposes, not only to prevent blackmail suits, but to prevent defense against peculiarly contentious litigation on the part of the defendant. So I think that type of restriction would cut two ways. And very briefly, as to the statute of limitations, again, this court has looked at the statute of limitations question and in the sense of one of the footnotes in Hockfelter saying that the state statute of limitations are fine. It may well be that this court believes some additional procedural limitations may be applicable to 10b-5, but has not so ruled, and I think the plaintiffs have been on the rule 10b-5, are appropriately been following the decision of the courts. If Congress wanted to have a limitation, as they did in another situation on the 1934 Act, in 1938 they amended a certain provision under 15c1 to provide for a 1-year and 3-year statute of limitations, they could have done so. They have not done so. It seems they have acquiesced in the decision of the courts to allow a statute of limitations under 10b-5 relating to the fraud, generally the fraud statute of the forum state. In short, I believe that this court should rule that in this case is the facts of this case bring out the need not to have one remedy exclude the other, but for the kind of relief which Hock felt the saw would be appropriate when there's scienter, when an accountant acts with scienter in connection with a false and misleading prospectus, he can be held liable under 10b-5. I also say that this case, again, is a good case. It's money damages. Herman McLean is not even alleged in any way that prevented from making a living, prevented from going on. They don't have to participate in the fraud in the prospectus. They have that choice. They don't have that, and if they don't want to participate in the fraud, instead of not giving a comfort letter, giving a comfort letter, excluding the question of construction, they should have said, let's not go forward with this issue. We can't give you the comfort because we know that those costs have greatly exceeded that in the prospectus. Therefore, let us revise the prospectus, be sure it sets forth the accurate figures. And then they would have been free of any liability. Thank you.
Mr. Gunson.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. In the Hockfelder case, the accountants there urged that they should not be liable under Section 10b for mere negligence. This Court agreed and held that scienter was required. The accountants here have been found by a jury to have acted with scienter. They asked this Court that they should not be held liable under Section 10b because Section 11 provides for liability for negligence. And they also argue that their conduct is not covered under Section 11. Their argument is that Congress intended that Section 11 be the exclusive remedy for false statements in a registered securities offering, even where the victims of that falsity cannot recover because Section 11 does not apply to the persons or the conduct involved. I will develop two responses. First, that Congress intended in 1975, when it comprehensively amended the Securities Exchange Act, to continue the Section 10b remedy, including its cumulative nature, and that the accountants have not carried their burden of demonstrating that Congress intended to carve out from that 10b-5 remedy protection for buyers for securities and registered offerings. Second, that the Section 11 and 10b remedies are very much different, and an analysis of those differences demonstrates Congress's intent that they should coexist. The central inquiry, we agree, as asked by Justice White, is legislative intent. And this Court noted in the Curran case that the inquiry logically differs depending upon whether a court is considering new legislation or legislation that Congress amended following its enactment. We point out in our brief that the Securities Acts have been amended on a number of occasions. The Securities Exchange Act in 1964, 1975, and 1977. I will focus on 1975, because in that year, Congress comprehensively examined and strengthened the Securities Exchange Act. It added 55 provisions to that act, amended 47 provisions, and left 85 provisions unchanged. It established a new national market system, a new system to clear and settle transactions in securities, and a new system bringing municipal securities dealers under federal regulation. It greatly strengthened SEC regulatory authority over securities brokers and securities exchanges. It strengthened the remedies available for SEC enforcement, but no new private remedies were added, nor were any changes made in the express private remedies, nor was Section 10b touched. Now, there can be no doubt that in 1975, the consensus of judicial opinion regarding the availability of the Section 10b private action was older and even more overwhelming than the development of the implied private action under the Commodity Exchange Act that was upheld in Curran. The extensive Section 10b case law included many federal court decisions holding that a Section 10b remedy was available even though the conduct may have been covered by an express remedy, including courts of appeals decisions from six circuits. In addition, there were a great many decisions allowing recovery under Section 10b without any discussion at all of whether an express remedy would apply, although from the facts of those cases, it appears that such express remedies probably would have applied, again establishing the widespread acceptance of the cumulative nature of the 10b remedy. Congress was also presumably aware in 1975 of this court's statement in 1969 in the national securities case that Section 10b was the most litigated provision of the federal securities laws and that some overlap in Section 10b with other sections is neither unusual nor inappropriate. So thus, for the same reasons that Congress's reexamination and amendment of the securities laws serves to ratify the existence of a private right of action generally under Section 10b, it serves also to ratify a conspicuous and a uniformly accepted characteristic of that right of action in 1975, its cumulative and supplemental nature. Indeed, the argument for the cumulative nature of the 10b remedy is a fortiori from Curran. There, this court held that new remedies added in 1974 to the Commodities Exchange Act, arbitration, and reparations, were limited and narrow in scope and did not substitute for the implied remedy either as a means of compensating injured traders or as a means of enforcing compliance with the statute. As mentioned, Congress created no new remedies in the Securities Exchange Act in 1975, adding strength to the presumption that it intended to continue the cumulative nature of the 10b-5 remedy, very well established in the case law. In addition to legislative ratification applying to the cumulative nature of the 10b-5 remedy, there's no evidence that Congress intended Section 11 to be the exclusive remedy for investors defrauded in a registered securities offering. In Section 16 of the Securities Act, Congress stated the rights and remedies in that act shall be in addition to any and all other rights which may exist at law and equity, and there's a similar provision in the Securities and Exchange Act. Beyond that, Congress declared the purpose in Section 2 of the Securities Exchange Act to impose requirements necessary to securities regulation and control reasonably complete and effective. This comported with President Roosevelt's call for securities legislation with teeth in it. I now turn to a comparison of the Section 11 and 10b remedies. Section 11 is a remedy which, while detailed, is quite narrow in what it covers. As has already been pointed out, it reaches a list of direct participants in an offering for misstatements in a registration statement. It doesn't reach others that may have played a role in the alleged fraud, such as, in this very case, accountants other than with respect to what we now refer to as the expertise portion of the document. To the extent Section 11 does apply, it greatly expands liability imposed at common law. It does not require proof of fraud. In Ultramarines, for example, cited by this court in his Hockfelder decision, Judge Cardozo, writing for the New York Court of Appeals, held that accountants owed a duty to investors to make their certificates without fraud, but did not owe a duty to investors to make that certificate without negligence. But Section 11 creates a duty on accountants running to investors to make their certificate without negligence. And Section 11 doesn't require proof of reliance or causation. 10b is more like the common law, requiring scienter, causation, and reliance. And not only in 10b must the plaintiff prove scienter, but he has the burden of proving scienter. In a Section 11 action, the defendant has the burden of showing absence from negligence. As the Second Circuit pointed out in Ross versus Robbins, cited in our brief, there is often a failure of proof, and the party who has the burden then, of course, loses. Now, because this new remedy under Section 11 favored plaintiffs so substantially, Congress did not extend this remedy to all conduct or to all persons. And moreover, to prevent abuse of the remedy, Congress provided for costs, attorney's fees in some cases, and a short statute of limitations. That, in a sense, is the trade-off. Our point is that because 10b is a different remedy and a more difficult one to sustain, if the plaintiff is able to sustain it, he proves fraud and the other components of the remedy, then he ought to be entitled to the remedy. And there's no reason to give the defendants the trade-off advantages of the short statute, security for costs, and so on, that are found in Section 11. Indeed, more than 30 years ago, Fishman versus Raytheon pointed out that the recognition that Section 10b is a different remedy provided the classic reconciliation of the express and the implied remedies. Fishman was noted by this court in Hockfelder, where this court's holding that scienter is required under Section 10b rested in part on the premise that the 10b remedy is cumulative of the express remedies in the Securities Act. As this court noted in Hockfelder, precisely because conduct which is actionable under Sections 11 and 12.2 also is actionable under Section 10b, adoption of a negligence standard under Section 10b, as was urged in that case, would, quote, allow causes of action covered by Sections 11 and 12.2 to be brought instead under Section 10b and thereby nullify the effectiveness of the carefully drawn procedural restrictions on those express actions. So this overlap provided a reason for a higher culpability standard under Section 10b. I close on the point I opened with. The defendant is an accounting firm. It is one of the persons who can be sued under Section 11, but only as an expert. But their conduct is alleged to have been to go much beyond that. And Mr. Truitt referred to allegations. The jury found them. It is difficult to impute to Congress an intention that the law in some cases should provide a remedy for negligence.
Your time has expired now, Mr.
Thank you,
Johnson. Do you have anything further, Mr. Truitt? You have three minutes remaining.
Thank you. I want to address myself first to what I understand to be the line of argument that this court in Hockfelter has approved the holding in Fishman. I think that's not true. I think this court in the Hockfelter case assumed the possibility that the Fishman analysis was correct and the possibility that there were overlapping remedies. I think it's important to note that in that place in the Hockfelter opinion where the language is found to which counsel refers, the court cites not only the Fishman case, which holds that there is an overlapping remedy, it also cites the Rosenberg case, which holds that there is not. I think it's clearly the case because of the fact that the court has left open the implied remedy issue, not only where the overlap is between 10b-5 and 11, but also in other situations where the overlap is between 10b-5 and Section 18 of the 34 Act. It's important to note that the court has left that issue open. I don't think it's appropriate to say that the court held in Hockfelter that the implied remedies, that overlapping remedies are to be permitted. Now, if I can address my attention just for a moment to the legislative reenactment line of argument, it seems to me that that line of argument, in effect, reverses the role of Congress and the courts. It assumes first that it is the function of this court to enact legislation to establish remedies. That is the function of Congress, and where Congress has enacted legislation to establish remedies and where it is said that a person may be liable in these circumstances and not in those, it's not appropriate for the court, through exercising a trade-off or in any other fashion, to override those limitations established by Congress. Even more importantly, for the legislative reenactment argument, it assumes that it is the function of the Congress to monitor the rulings of the lower federal courts, and where those rulings are incorrect, to reverse them by means of amendatory legislation. That's not the function of Congress. That's the function of the courts of appeals and of this court. One other serious problem with the legislative reenactment doctrine is that it applies only in those circumstances where the holding in question does not bear the weight of legal analysis. If the holding in question bore the weight of legal analysis, it would not be necessary to make reference to legislative reenactment as providing some sort of independent support. One could look simply at the holding under question and hold that is correct. Thirdly, I think that there is a distinction, which is sometimes missed, between awareness of a holding and ratification of that holding. For example, the Commission points to the enactment of 21G of the 1934 Act, which provides that a implied cause of action may not be consolidated, or, excuse me, not an implied cause of action, that a private action, whether implied or express, may not be consolidated with a Commission action in the absence of a consent by the Commission. Now, indeed, that statute does indicate an awareness, but I submit does not indicate an approval. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted.